AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're wading into some really complex territory, looking at sources covering everything from, well, some pretty wild constitutional maneuvers to serious economic jitters, and even how local elections are being fundamentally reshaped.
That's right. We've got legal analyses, economic reports, ground-level strategy docs. Mm-hmm. And what really jumps out is how interconnected it all seems to be.
Yeah, it feels like different fronts in the same battle, almost. The sources suggest key institutions, the courts, the civil service, the Fed, election laws, they're all facing these strategic pressures, these workarounds.
Exactly. So our goal today for you listening is to really connect those dots, show you the specific tactics being used across these different areas.
Okay, so we'll kick off with this whole third term question, the lengths some are apparently considering to get around the 22nd Amendment.
Then we'll pivot to the economy. The Fed's making big calls, but the data situation is looking really shaky, flying blind, basically.
And finally, we'll dig into how power is being contested right down to the state and local level, from gerrymandering pushes to, believe it or not, your local utility board.
Sounds like a plan. Let's start with that constitutional big one, the third term idea.
Right. So the 22nd Amendment seems pretty clear, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Two terms, period.
It does. And interestingly, the sources mentioned Donald Trump himself publicly saying something like, based on what I read, I guess I'm not allowed to run.
Uh-huh.
But despite that acknowledgement, there's clearly this intense interest in finding a way around it. The motivation seems pretty straightforward. Staying in the White House is seen as the best shield against potential prosecutions later on.
Okay, so if running directly is off the table, what are these convoluted workarounds, the sources detail? Let's start with the VP one.
Ah, yes, the VP resignation strategy. It sounds simple initially, but it's legally fraught and politically risky.
How's it supposed to work? Exactly.
The idea is this. You run on a ticket, say Vance Trump. They win. Then almost immediately, Vice President Vance resigns. And under the 25th Amendment, Trump, as VP, would then become president.
Hmm.
Step three, President Trump nominates Vance to be his vice president again.
Wow, that's intricate and cynical, maybe. What's the legal argument that even allows for considering this?
It all hangs on a very specific reading of the 12th Amendment combined with the 22nd. The core question is, does the 22nd Amendment make someone ineligible to the office of president? Meaning they can't be elected president again.
Mm.
Or does it ban them from serving as president beyond two terms, no matter how they get there? If, and it's a big yes, five Supreme Court justices decided it only bans election, well, then this VP resignation route potentially opens the door to serving multiple future terms.
But the risks seem enormous. What if the VP just doesn't resign?
That's the huge gamble. The sources point this out directly. Trust. You'd be relying entirely on someone like Vance, in this hypothetical, to actually step down. History isn't exactly reassuring there, I think, to Aaron Burr back in 1800. He could just say, nope, change my mind, I'm president now. And the other key thing from the sources, apparently Trump himself dismissed this whole idea as too cute.
Too cute. Interesting. So even he sees the potential backlash or, well, the sheer awkwardness of it.
It suggests a recognition that making such an obvious kind of gamey maneuver the core of your path back to power might be politically toxic, regardless of the legal theory.
Okay, so that brings us to the other path mentioned, the Speaker of the House route. This one sounds even more complicated.
Oh, it is. This is pure political theater meets constitutional arcana. Step one, get elected Speaker of the House on January 3rd, 2029. Constitutionally, there's nothing stopping a former president, or really almost anyone, from becoming Speaker.
Okay, so they're Speaker. Then what?
Then, on Inauguration Day, January 20th, both the newly elected president and the newly elected vice president would have to resign simultaneously.
Both of them?
Both. That clears the decks, and under the presidential line of succession, the Speaker of the House becomes president.
Well, wait, isn't the Speaker only acting president in that scenario?
Exactly. That's the massive vulnerability. They serve only as acting president until a new vice president is nominated and confirmed by Congress.
So it's incredibly precarious.
Extremely. Your hold on power literally depends on your own heartbeat. If something happens to the acting president before a VP is confirmed, the presidency passes to the next person in line, the speaker pro tempore, or the Senate president pro tempore.
And if Congress has flipped or is divided?
You could inadvertently hand power right back to the opposition party. It requires a Republican House majority to even attempt. Mm. And it's fragile every step of the way.
All right, let's shift from these sort of grand constitutional schemes to something maybe less dramatic, but just as impactful. The rules around government administration, specifically appointments.
Yes, the sources highlight real tension around the Vacancies Act, particularly that 120-day limit for temporary appointments. It's meant to ensure Senate oversight, right? To stop presidents from just installing unconfirmed people indefinitely.
But the claim is that this limit is being deliberately ignored.
Repeatedly. The pattern described is using temporary appointments to install people. The Senate likely wouldn't confirm. The sources use terms like totally unqualified toadies. They mention specific examples like Alina Haba in New Jersey, Sigal Chadha in Nevada.
And this recently came to a head in that Los Angeles case, the Asaley ruling. Tell us about that clumsy ruse.
Right. So the background is Bill Asaley was serving as an acting U.S. attorney. Just before his 120 days were up, AG Pam Bondi's office fired him.
Fired him?
Yes, only to immediately reappoint him as the first assistant U.S. attorney, with the clear expectation he'd then step back into the acting U.S. attorney role through that position.
Trying to reset the clock, essentially.
Pretty much. But Judge Michael Seabright wasn't having it. He called it a clumsy ruse and ruled that Asaley had unlawfully assumed the role the second time around. He disqualified him from being acting U.S. attorney, though he could stay as first assistant.
Okay, one judge, one district. Why does this ripple outwards?
Because it potentially sets a precedent. The argument being made now is that other high-profile officials like Lindsey Halligan, who signed indictments against Letitia James and James Comey in Virginia, were also put in place using similar maneuvers after their 120-day limits arguably expired. If the Asaley logic holds, those indictments could be challenged, maybe even invalidated.
And for Comey specifically.
That's the critical part. The statute of limitations on the potential charges against Comey has apparently run out. So if the indictment is invalid due to Halligan's appointment being improper, they likely can't just issue a new one. The case could just evaporate.
Wow. Based on an administrative appointment rule.
That's
something. Okay, let's look at the Pentagon now. Secretary Pete Hegseth and this push to remove civilian workers.
Yeah, this is another angle on administrative power. The sources describe a move to significantly speed up firing civilian defense employees.
How are they doing that? Aren't there usually protections, appeals processes?
There are. But this new internal memo apparently focuses on streamlining terminations for poor performance. Crucially, it seems to cut out prior steps like mandated improvement plans or multiple warnings.
So it makes it faster, easier to fire individuals one by one.
Exactly. Which might be a way to avoid the legal challenges that could block a large-scale sudden layoff or purge. It's firing by a thousand cuts, perhaps.
But the sources suggest the real target isn't just poor performers in the traditional sense.
That seems to be the core issue highlighted. The claim is that poor performance is being redefined, or at least reinterpreted, to mean disloyal.
Disloyal to whom or what?
Disloyal, according to the sources, means not subscribing to Donald Trump's agenda. So political alignment is effectively being equated with job competence. It's framed as an ideological purge masked as performance management.
And the scale of this is significant.
Apparently so. The material mentions the Pentagon having already shed about 60,000 civilian positions. That's around 8% of that workforce. This memo looks designed to accelerate removing those deemed politically unreliable or, you know, just not with the program.
Okay, let's pivot to the economy. Things feel unstable, costs are high, but the sources suggest there's another layer here, a problem with the data itself. The Fed just cut rates by 0.25%.
Right, but the context provided is that they made that call while basically flying blind.
Flying blind? Why? What's wrong with the economic data?
Two big problems outlined. First, leadership instability at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS. Remember, Donald Trump fired the nonpartisan head, Erica McTarfer, reportedly over disagreements about the numbers.
Right, and her replacement.
Was nominated but then withdrawn. So the BLS, which collects critical data on jobs and inflation, has been operating without confirmed nonpartisan leadership for a while. That raises questions about data collection and interpretation.
Okay, so that's one issue. What's the other factor making the Fed fly blind?
The government shutdown. it directly halted or delayed the collection of a lot of the raw economic data the Fed relies on, things like retail sales, construction spending, you name it.
So they cut rates even though inflation was reportedly rising and unemployment too.
Exactly. It was a gamble. If underlying inflation is actually the bigger long-term threat, cutting rates was the wrong move.
Okay.
It could pour fuel on the fire. But if recession was the immediate danger, maybe it was necessary. The point is, the decision seems to have been made with much less reliable information than usual, possibly driven more by political pressure to do something than by solid economics.
And meanwhile, families are feeling the pinch directly. That rate cut isn't going to fix everything, especially these retail rate spikes like in Pennsylvania.
No, it won't. Pennsylvania's situation is stark. The sources state it has the highest grocery price inflation in the country right now, 8.2% year over year as of July 2025. That's huge.
And nearby states, too?
Yeah. West Virginia at 6.9%, New Jersey at 6.8%, also very high.
What's driving those numbers? Is it just general inflation or specific things?
It seems to be a mix, but with some specific drivers really hitting hard. The report mentions rapid increases in basics, grains, beans, pasta up over 5% just in a short period, much faster than the national average for those items.
Okay.
Plus, you've got persistently high diesel fuel costs hitting transportation, overall regional inflation being higher in the Northeast for food and energy anyway, and maybe even issues with low market competition among grocers in some areas.
So these are supply side problems, mostly. Things a Fed rate cut doesn't really address.
Precisely. Rate cuts work on the demand side, trying to stimulate borrowing and spending. They don't make wheat cheaper or lower the cost of trucking food across the country. Global commodity issues, transport costs, those are outside the Fed's direct control.
And there's another potential cost shock looming: healthcare. The ACA preview for 2026 sounds alarming.
It really does. The headline number is a projected average nationwide premium increase of around 26%, which is substantial in itself.
But the bigger hit comes from the subsidies, right? Right.
That's the potential catastrophe. The enhanced federal subsidies, the premium tax credits that have made ACA plans affordable for millions, are set to expire if Congress doesn't act to extend them.
What happens?
Out-of-pocket costs for people getting those subsidies could, on average, more than double. The figure cited is a potential 114% increase in what people actually pay.
114% jump? Why would Congress let that happen? It seems politically dangerous.
Well, it creates massive leverage, doesn't it? But the impact on people is severe. The sources use a specific example. A 60-year-old couple in York County, Pennsylvania. Their current annual premium with subsidies might be around $7,000.
Okay.
If those subsidies expire. Their bill could shoot up to over $35,000 a year for the same coverage. That's just unaffordable for most people. It's a cliff edge tied directly to congressional action or inaction.
Okay, final segment. Let's look at the electoral map itself and how the rules governing it are being challenged. The sources point to the Supreme Court and the Voting Rights Act. What's at stake there?
The expectation discussed is that the court might significantly weaken or gut the last major operative piece of the VRA.
And that piece is, what does it do?
It's basically the main legal tool left to challenge racially discriminatory gerrymandering, you know, states drawing electoral maps that dilute the voting power of minority groups. Section 2 is the key part remaining.
So if that's weakened, what's the expected outcome?
The sources suggest, particularly in southern states, there's a real eagerness, champing at the bit, is the phrase used to redraw congressional and state legislative maps to maximize partisan advantage, often by packing minority voters into fewer districts or spreading them out thinly to make nearly every district majority white, aiming for districts that are maybe 70% white, 30% minority, for example.
And there are specific examples of this ambition.
Yeah, South Carolina's Elting Governor Pamela Vett is quoted wanting a clean sweep, explicitly aiming to eliminate the congressional district currently held by Jim Clyburn, a long-serving Black Democrat.
So the goal is purely partisan gain, using race as the tool once the VRA constraints are lifted.
That appears to be the strategy described. Now, there are some potential roadblocks. Florida, for instance, actually has language in its state constitution banning maps drawn primarily for partisan gain.
But
Governor DeSantis has appointed 5 of the 7 justices on the Florida Supreme Court. So how that state constitutional provision would be interpreted is an open question. Also, timing is tight. The Supreme Court would need to rule pretty quickly for states to draw and implement radically new maps before the 2026 election.
Okay, so that's the high-level state and federal map manipulation. But the sources also talk about a push much further down the ballot into races that are usually, well, nonpartisan.
This is a really significant trend highlighted. The idea that local elections, city councils, school boards, even things like water boards or utility commissions should be nonpartisan is being actively challenged.
How so? Who's doing it?
Groups like Turning Point USA, now led by Erica Kirk, according to the sources, are reportedly making a concerted effort to inject partisanship into these low-profile races, to turn them into explicit Republican versus Democrat contests, even if the ballot doesn't list party labels.
Can you give an example?
The recall election mentioned in Mesa City, Arizona, they're targeting a Republican council member, Julie Spilsbury. Not because she's a Democrat, she's not, but because she's seen as not aligned enough with the Mangia wing of the party. She apparently supported Kamala Harris at some point.
So it's about ideological purity within the party being enforced even in nonpartisan roles.
Exactly. And it extends beyond just city councils. TPUSA is reportedly targeting positions like the Salt River Project Board. That's a major water and power provider in Arizona. The stated goal is to oust people they label radical environmentalists and influence energy and climate policy at that very local but impactful level.
The sources observe that this makes the whole idea of nonpartisan elections feel like a fairy tale.
Yeah, because the strategy is asymmetric. One side is heavily investing resources, identifying candidates, mobilizing voters based on party affiliation for these races. They're aiming to outregister opponents, sometimes 10 to 1, in specific local contexts.
While the other side might still be operating under the old assumption that these races should be neutral.
That seems to be the dynamic. So you get this gradual capture of local institutions, not through direct election changes, but by fundamentally changing the nature of the contests themselves, often under the radar. Hashtag tag outro.
So wrapping this all up, when you look across these different areas, the constitutional questions, the administrative power plays, the economic data issues, the electoral map fights, there really is a common thread, isn't there?
There is. It's a consistent challenge to establish rules, norms, and institutions, whether it's the 22nd Amendment's term limits, the 120D rule for appointments, the Voting Rights Act's protections, or even just the basic reliance on objective nonpartisan government data.
Right. It feels like a multi-pronged pressure test on the systems designed for, well, stability and neutrality. Constitutional succession, bureaucratic impartiality, data integrity, they all seem to be in the crosshairs.
And ultimately, when rules are bent or broken, you look to the legal system for accountability. Which brings us to one final point from the sources. The status of those fake elector cases.
Yes. Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Wisconsin. What's the update there?
The truly startling thing is this. It's now 4 years since the events of 2020. Indictments were filed. But as of the time of these sources, not a single one of these fake elector cases has actually gone to trial.
4 years. Why the delay? That seems extraordinary for something so central to the election process.
The sources point to a cascade of procedural issues and failures. You have the controversy surrounding DA Fani Willis's conduct in Georgia, potentially delaying things there. In Michigan, a judge actually dismissed charges against some electors, bizarrely stating they weren't savvy or sophisticated enough to understand what they were doing.
Seriously. And in Nevada, there were legal battles just over whether the case was filed in the correct venue, the right county. Mm-hmm. So, see, procedural roadblocks, questionable judicial rulings, venue disputes, all contributing to massive delays.
So the old saying, justice delayed is justice denied, seems relevant here.
Very much so. And it leads to the final question we wanted to leave you with, something to really think about based on everything we've discussed today.
Okay.
If serious attempts to interfere with or subvert an election occur, and our legal system, through procedural snags, venue arguments, maybe even defenses, claiming political naivete, proves unable to even bring those cases to trial within 4 years. What does that delay signal? What does it tell us about the rule of law's ability to handle politically charged, time-sensitive offenses? And perhaps more importantly, what message does it send about the potential consequences, or lack thereof, for trying similar things in the future?
A sobering thought to end on. That's definitely something for all of us to chew on.